Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We've got a great show for you this week. Plenty of cars that we've been driving. Everything from the Ram Rebel to the Range Rover, the original one, let's put it that way. We've also tested the Honda CR-V, the Cadillac Lyriq, the Acura Integra, and the Honda Civic Hatch in sport touring trim. We will spend your money. And with that, I'll bring in senior editor for all things up and down the West Coast, as well as our reviews, James Ryswick. Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. A lot of cars to drive here. I think it makes sense to start off with the Ram Rebel. You drove that primarily off-road. Initial impressions?
Yeah, so I really did drive it. A very rock-strewn trail here in California, just outside of Big Bear, which is about 2 hours east of Los Angeles in the mountains. And so what the Rebel is, there's the Ram Power Wagon, which is the ultimate off-roading truck. Basically what the Rebel is it subtracts some of the Power Wagon's hardware, because a big part of the Power Wagon is its like insane articulation off-road, and that's allowed, and that's made possible by softer springs, a disconnecting front sway bar. It also has a front locker on it. Those are not on the Rebel. By having firmer springs in particular, that allows it to have substantially more towing capacity. So it's about 16,000 versus only about 10,000 for the Power Wagon, which is more like a 1500 level towing capacity. So it's more of a heavy duty truck than a rock crawler. That said, it's still, you know, it's still a pretty significant rock crawler in its own right. I was crawling rocks in it. It's also like a colossal truck. So you are limited by the trails you can go on. I mean, it's kind of perfect for desert trails because you're not really like meandering around trees as much because there aren't that many giant trees. So that's what the Rebel was. And is it how much more capable was it in this terrain than a Tremor? I don't know. I didn't have one there. To be perfectly honest, I'm not a big off-roadist. It's a pretty significant truck. One thing I will say though is like, because of those firmer springs, I'm thinking, and the disconnecting sway bar, it is probably not as comfortable as a Power Wagon. And also I have the Ram 1500 out there, and the difference in ride quality between a 2500 and a 1500 Limited is just staggeringly different. The Ram 1500 is more like that Range Rover, honestly, than it is its 2500 Rebel sibling.
I am more of a Power Wagon person than a Ram Rebel. I just like the kind of meat and potatoes elements, the authenticity of what the Power Wagon is. But you bring up the Range Rover, which I believe you drove to this test drive. That's a pretty comfy way to get acclimated for, you know, a day of, you know, testing with your fellow auto journalists.
Yeah, I knew I had to drive 3 hours out to where this event was in Pioneer Town. Did not know it existed. It is kind of as described. It's an old Western town, like an hour north of Palm Springs. So I was like, I need to drive the Range Rover. Let's get it that week. That'll be nice. And it was nice. That car is just gorgeous, especially after you've been rattled and shaken and jostled and had your head smashed repeatedly against the B pillar because I sit so far back in the truck off road. It was pretty nice to get into the Range Rover after that and have the massaging seats and just everything. That car's just butter. Everything's just like smooth, like a knife through butter. Steering and throttle and brakes and the suspension and everything is just new Range Rover. Very, very nice.
I liked it too. I ended up doing the first drive of it earlier this year. Mine had the copper sort of paint, if you will, the bronze colored paint. Mm-hmm. I think we drove similar vehicles, right? Because you had a first edition as well, right?
Yeah, I had the gold one though. So we both had the first editions, but and then we each had the kind of signature designs of them. I think there's a white version as well for a signature design, but that was like what the design or the colors and materials team kind of put together as like their ultimate vision of what it is. And you know, we talk about styling a lot in cars and kind of making it interchangeable with design, but at least in like styling has like give the design, but then styling is really like what colors and the trims, and like in the fashion world, styling would be like, oh, what purse you put with that dress, not like what does the dress look like, if that makes any sense. So like in terms of styling of this Range Rover, it is just impeccable. Like you have this gold matte paint on mine. It photographed beautifully, and it looks, for a gold car, which could be pretty kind of crass and tasteless, it just drips with class. It looks really great. And the interior is beautiful, lovely. Like they really just had thoughtful, really well done materials in that car. Mix of black and white, or you know, like white, you know, creamy leather. And then you have kind of this like pinkish oak trim in it that's just beautiful. Really, really well done. I actually did an article last year about the color and design, the color and materials designer at Land Rover, the kind of highlights her process, how she got into it, and just that world in general. It's something we don't really think about that often, but it does really come into play and make a big difference in these cars.
The interior quality of the new Range Rover is definitely, it's spot on. You know, they made it look expensive and premium without being like, I would say almost ornamental, which some companies can struggle with. So I like that. I also got to work an Oasis headline or song reference into the headline. I colored or compared the color to champagne, which I haven't had any champagne in a while, but yeah, I think that could describe how this looks a little bit. Maybe I need to do some more first class flying, I guess, where they give you a little flute of champagne or something when you get on the plane. I don't know. But handsome vehicle for sure. And that twin turbo V8 is obviously great. You know, pretty strong. It's a BMW engine, if I recall.
Yeah, it is. But it doesn't sound or feel like a BMW engine. It sounds like, I'd say it sounds like a Jaguar. It's kind of cheesy to say that a Jaguar engine like purrs, but it kind of does. It's like this rumbling purring, like the old supercharged V8s of Jags. And it kind of sounds like that. They've really done a lovely job. This is kind of like the Toyota Supra thing. Like, oh no, it has a BMW engine. Like, cool. Like, what, how is that possibly a problem? Also, it's kind of ironic or interesting because the modern Range Rover started as a BMW. So like the turn of the century Range Rover that kind of reinvented the entire Range Rover brand and itself is a kind of an iconic design that everything thereafter was built upon. That was done in the BMW era. And that car, that SUV had a BMW V8 in it. And even its electrical architecture was related to a BMW 5 Series. All the Range Rovers that came after and even Land Rovers were not related to it because of that, because they got sold to Ford during its development. So little trivia there for you folks.
I think BMW owes, you know, Land Rover here, considering they, you know, they actually probably deserve a little more credit for their management of Land Rover than perhaps Ford does. I mean, neither one of them were particularly good stewards of the brand in the long run, but hey.
Well, I always think, so I have a second generation BMW X5, and I always thought that thing, it kind of drives like a Range Rover. Like I think, and then I've never driven the original X5, But if it's, you know, if there's any sort of similarity, you know, BMW, Range Rover rubbed off on BMW a bit, at least in that era for their SUVs. And even like a BMW X7 today, the way it drives, specifically with that air suspension, behaves a little, feels more like a modern Range Rover and drives more like it than some like classic BMW feel. Even down, the other thing, the Range Rover has the tailgate. It has the split like little tailgate that flips down and then you have to do the lift gate. Well, the X5 has the exact same thing, same era. I refuse to believe that's a coincidence. I think someone had the same idea and put them on both, and they've both had them ever since.
All right. Well, while we're talking about SUVs, let's step down a little bit to a more mainstream vehicle, the Honda CR-V. I drove the hybrid. Which one did you drive?
I guess I drove both. But I specifically drove the hybrid more. I was on the okay. first drive, so I just briefly drove the turbo. Night and day, like turbo's fine. The turbo's actually a really strong engine in terms of both power and fuel efficiency. But it has that CVT, and anytime you say "but it has that CVT," we're always going to end up with, and as such, it's not very appealing. But a key difference for this new hybrid, it's a little more powerful than it was before. But the big difference is drivability for this generation. And what they've done is, so Honda's hybrid, how do I explain this without completely going into the weeds? So Honda's hybrid system is different than Toyota's and different than Hyundai and Kia's, in that the electric motor primarily drives the wheels. The only time the gas engine is connected to the wheels is in a constant cruise on the highway. That's the only time. So when you accelerate from a stop, you're just going, it's only the electric motor powering it. The gas engine is simply sending power to that motor, or as well as the battery is. So because of this, the standard to this date, the Honda motor, you would put your foot on the, if you really gunned it, the engine would just kind of like drone, because it's not really a CVT, but it kind of sounds like one, because it just the most efficient and the most efficient way for gas and acceleration is just to rev the engine, to put as much power into that electric motor as you can. But, you know, no one likes listening to that. I don't like listening to myself doing that. So what they've done with this is they've actually artificially pausing the engine to make it seem like it's shifting gears. So it's kind of bizarre in that it feels, at first blush, it feels totally normal, because it's going wah, wah, like we as the engineer said, it's what humans have come to expect for 100 years. So it now feels and sounds normal. But then it's a little weird in that the car doesn't lose any momentum. So when you drive in an automatic transmission, there's just like that slight loss of momentum that you feel. Well, this car doesn't have that because the engine's not actually attached to the wheels. So you just, it's uninterrupted acceleration. Meanwhile, you hear the quote gear change that the engine just briefly pauses. It does lose, the engineer said it just loses, you know, like a tiny fraction of efficiency and acceleration. But it just feels and sounds better. And then on the sport touring, they've added, you know, they have a little bit of engine enhancement noise that comes over the speakers. I don't think it's that much, but by pausing the engine in that way, it kind of regains some of that like lovely Honda zing that you get when a Honda engine revs. You really get this with the a Honda Civic with a manual and one with the CVT. They sound and feel like completely different engines, even though they're the exact same ones. And you kind of get that. There's like, it's a weird thing where this hybrid suddenly sounds kind of cool. And it sounds a lot better than the CVT-equipped turbo one. And it also goes to the fact that you can only get the hybrid now as the Sport and Sport Touring. You cannot get the EX and EXL are exclusive to the gas one. So you can't get a Sport with a turbo and then vice versa. It really is the sportier choice. And it also can get like 40 miles per gallon with front wheel drive or like 37 with all wheel drive, which for a compact SUV is exceptional. It's kind of what they all get, honestly. But still, like, so it drives better, it performs better, and it gets way better fuel economy. Why are we getting anything else? Like, Honda's expecting to sell like up like kind of 50-50 of the hybrid, and apparently is able to, unlike Kia, who that can't quite keep up with demand for its also very desirable hybrid powertrain.
I think it's a big step forward too, as far as the interior and the exterior design. I think Honda has gotten a little boring with the CR-V. I've always liked how it looks, especially amongst some of its perhaps even more boring competitors. But I thought they really found a sweet spot kind of in the mid, like the mid-teens here, if you will. It got a little dated, but I like this one. I think the interior has, it's a cliche to say it's sporty, but they have a very nice setup, you know, as far as the use of like the trim, the venting, the infotainment, that sort of thing. So I only drove it for about probably 20 minutes, 25 minutes, but that immediately struck me as like, hey, they've definitely freshened the place up. They've done some remodeling, as you would expect. And I think that's important in this segment. You've got to really have a good interior that it doesn't have to be like amazing, but it can't be offensive or even feel cheap. And I thought it felt pretty good. So
yeah, I would say that like the CR-V interior has always been pretty van-like going back to the absolute beginning. It was always very open. Even it had like the open like floor in between seats up until like I think the most recent generation. And it looked van-like, and as such, it always kind of had this like very family appliance feel to it. And I don't want to drive a family appliance. I need a family appliance, but I don't want to have it feel like I'm driving the car version of my kid's stroller or the car seat. Actually, my kid's stroller looks far cooler than the last Honda CR-V, which was kind of blobby. And even when not comparing it to a Thule stroller, it does not look good, especially when you line it up to the new one. The new one's a little longer, but it sure looks to me like it's just because they made the hood longer, which generally evens out the proportions of it. It's just more squared off, more athletic. I think it's more in keeping with like the 90s kind of Honda aesthetic. And it really works for me. As you said, the interior looks fantastic. Between that and what Mazda's doing, like you do not need to have some blah utilitarian cabin anymore. Actually, the Nissan Rogue is also really nice. Actually, it's hard to think of one that isn't at this point. So well done, everybody.
Bravo. Although I will say this, the stroller comparison, strollers have gotten so bougie lately that, I mean, sometimes it's tough for the auto industry to keep up. We had a City Mini GT that had an amazing off-road suspension. We still have it. We just don't use it anymore. But I'm telling you what, you need to go through the park. That stroller had you covered. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. You did all the ones with like the little, that you spent, you know, like $100 more to buy the one with a little bit of brown leather on the handle. Like, hard eye roll. Meanwhile, you tried to fold the thing and it's gigantic and like isn't really, you know, well engineered. But hey, it has some brown leather on it.
It's funny though, that also applies to the car business, right? Yeah. You spend a little extra money to get a little bit of brown leather on the door handles or something.
Yeah, but no kidding.
I digress. Speaking of design, the Cadillac Lyriq is all about design. I drove that, again, probably for about half an hour. It was a fairly short drive. Was very impressed with it. I drove it like basically the day after the Cadillac Celestiq was revealed. So it was kind of sort of, it was cool to feel the, like the parallels between the two. They were designed about the same time actually. And, you know, the big difference is the Lyriq is a mainstream crossover aimed at premium buyers. They're going to try and sell a bunch of them. It's what keeps Cadillac's bottom line going. Whereas the Celestiq is a $300,000, you know, Rolls Royce fighter, if you will, that's like 18 feet long. Most people probably won't be able to afford the Celestiq, but for about 60 grand, you could get into a Lyriq. And I think you get a lot of the, you know, the aura, if you will, of where Cadillac is going with its design. So, you know, inside and out, I liked it. It, you know, it definitely captures some of that sort of like design language that Cadillac's going for. I think they've had some of that momentum with the, like the CT4 or the CT5. This takes it, turns it up even more. It's almost like where Cadillac was like 10 years ago when the CTS was just so like hard edged, if you will. But this, I think, is classier than some of that too. You know, I mean, check out the pictures, you know, the grill. I really like that. You know, it's also an LED light show inside and out because that's Cadillac's move basically. Drove pretty well. I mean, it's a cliche. It has a little bit of that car vibe, but it's not too, like, it's obviously not super sporty like a CT4 would be, but it also doesn't feel like some dowdy SUV that you're trundling through the roads in and feeling kind of sad that this is what you have to drive. It, like, it's fun to drive. I think it could be a fairly, sporty station wagon if given a different stance and given a different sort of suspension calibration. It's electric, of course. This is another Ultium product. But yeah, I mean, this is one of the more promising Cadillacs I've driven in a while. I think Cadillac has actually rolled out some pretty good products. They haven't always sold quite where Cadillac thinks they should, or they've been fairly niche. You know, they rolled out the CT4 and the CT5 like right at the time when everybody is going crossovers for everything. So it's tricky to sort of pivot that way, but I think the Lyriq being an electric crossover sort of starts to solve some of that. So I don't know. It sounds like it's on your list of things to get into, James.
Yeah, I think, you know, I credit Cadillac for trying to like finally like go their own way and not try to like for just, for the better part of like 20 years now, they've been trying to like beat BMW. Mm-hmm. So this just seems like a so much more authentic, like we're gonna be Cadillac. This is the future. And I think electrification is allowing them to do that so that they can get at the forefront as opposed to constantly trying to catch up. I would say that the Celestiq might be like a couple of steps kind of shockingly far. Like, it's so upstream that you wonder what you're going to accomplish. Like, it would be one thing to have something like S-Class money, but like, so few people can buy a $300,000 car that so few people will see them on the road that you therefore, like, it's hard to see it having much trickle down brand equity to it. Because even I live in Los Angeles, the greater Los Angeles area, there be money here. I see a lot more S classes around in cars that cost about $100,000 to $150,000 than I do Rolls Royces, of which I don't see many, very many. So pivoting from Lyriq for a second, but like I have a hard time seeing how Celestiq will really help them unless there's something coming just behind it that's a little more attainable. But yeah, that's, I don't doubt that they can make a very lovely $300,000 car. I just don't know how it can really be that beneficial for them.
All right. So that is the Cadillac Lyriq and a little bit of the Cadillac Celestiq. Let's shift gears over to the, we can take these in any order. The Acura Integra, which I believe we've both driven, and you drove the Let's see, the Civic Hatch Sport Touring, which is sort of an Integra, only dressed a little bit differently.
Yeah.
You say you'd rather have that than the Integra, so I guess defend your position.
Okay.
We'll do that first.
So I had the Integra, and cool car. I mean, it's kind of a rebodied Civic Si, a little more refined. It has the adaptive dampers on it, more equipment. You can get it with, you know, leather upholstery, power seats. And it was legitimately fun to drive, just as you would expect a front wheel drive, like a fun, nicer Honda Civic would be. And I enjoy driving it quite a bit. But then I got this Civic Hatchback Sport Touring with a 6-speed manual transmission. And I would rather have it than the Integra. For starters, it's like $8,000 less, and you're sacrificing about 30 horsepower. Okay, but you don't have to put premium gas into it. Also, it's still that turbo engine, so it feels really quick. And when you have that manual transmission, you can get the most out of it. The manual is an absolute joy in both Integra and in the Civic. And because it's the Sport Touring, it's loaded. Like, I'm sitting in a wonderful 8-way power seat, very comfortable. The entire interior is leather. And unlike the Integra, because the Integra A-Spec has, up front, it is like the suede-ish cloth. And then the back seat is pleather. It's leatherette. They're different upholsteries. And in red, it all just looks very cheap. Even in black, it would still be pleather in the back, suede in the front. I do not get that. That just seems so cheap to me. Whereas the Civic, same upholstery everywhere, all black interior, classy. I think that the Civic kind of looks better on the outside, and it definitely looks better inside because it has that. They both have the Honda mesh venting, but the Civic goes all the way across and looks super cool. And the Integra's is broken up by this blah painted black or gray plastic. Nothing about the Integra interior is more luxurious than the Civic Hatch. It has a few more features, specifically memory seats. But it has the same tech interface, and I don't really 30 horsepower seems to be, and those adaptive dampers. But the Civic Hatch Sport Touring still handles very well. It's a blast to drive. It's still very comfortable for $8,000. Not a chance. And they're both hatchbacks, by the way. And I'd buy that Civic. In fact, I love that Civic so much. If I needed to go out and buy a car right now, I'd go buy that car. It was such a joy, such a joyful little car. I loved it very much.
Wow. Strong words there. All right. We'll spend your money, I guess, on the show too, a little bit. All right. Well, I don't disagree with your argument. I think there's also, that's kind of like the age old argument too, is the Civic bumps up against the Integra depending on the trim. The Civic Si is also, if you want the exact same engine, same horsepower, you could do it as far as, you know, bumping up against the Integra as well. I haven't driven this specific Civic, so I don't really have a great comparison. I can tell you, I think, and I'd be curious to hear what you think, it's tough to bring back a name like the Integra, and I thought they did that about as well as they could. You know, it wasn't the old Integra by any stretch, but it still felt like a credible product that as an enthusiast, you could get excited about. So I give them credit for that. I generally like A-Spec trims, although sometimes they almost like, they need to get over themselves a little bit and just don't worry as much about being sporty or basic and be sure to be nice, if you will. So I think that can be a pitfall. And it's tough when you have a mainstream brand like Honda, and then your premium brand is Acura, but you're like really a premium brand. You're not competing with BMW or anybody else either. You're really more of a, like, just like one or two cuts up versus going all the way up the food chain. So I will say this. I do like the purity of a civic sport, if you will. So
yeah, the other thing is like versus so bring in Civic Si here. So okay, that also has the engine, but part of the Integra's appeal is its extra refinement over mm-hmm. that Civic Si. And the Civic Xi, I think it's a little tacky. It like this is a car that you can get an orange and electric blue, yet the interior is always red. Sorry, that doesn't really go. And then speaking of mismatched backseat and front seats, yeah, the Civic Si's front seats are red with some kind of like this mesh-like material. The back seat's just plain Jane black cloth. Same deal. And like what I don't get why this. I guess they could say, oh, we're trying to be designy, but when it's so differently, like the upholstery quality is so different, it just reeks of like bean counting. And this, again, Civic Hatch doesn't have that. It is a classier car than the Civic Si, and I'd rather have that and save a bunch of money and, yeah, sacrifice some horsepower and still have a lot of fun and still enjoy like a well-rounded car. But I think it's better than both of them while we're at it.
All right. We definitely have a strong defense of the Honda position here. All right. Cool. So that is our drive section. We have a rather lengthy spend my money, so we might as well get into it. It's a repeat customer, first of all. So thank you for writing back. Hayden in Minnesota. He wrote back in March 2017, a different time, a different place. Let's put it that way. First of all, so I'll kind of sum this up here. First of all, thanks for keeping the podcast going. Hey, thanks for listening. He's been listening for over 5 years and appreciates staying up to date. Let's see. He was featured back in March of 17, like we said. At that time, he was selling a 2000 Toyota Celica, and he ended up getting a 2008 Civic Si. There you go, James, a Civic Si.
That's a cool car.
There you go. Great car. He sold it in 2020. Probably made a little bit of, maybe didn't make a ton of money, but 2020, 2021, not a bad time to sell a car. Still isn't. It's a little rougher time to buy a car, though. Convinced he needed a larger vehicle, so what did he get? A 2011 FJ Cruiser.
That's an even cooler car. I love that thing.
I like the FJ cooler. FJ Cruiser. That was a fun one.
I love that thing. For a while there, that was like the coolest thing. The most fun car that Toyota sold. Even to drive. Wasn't even close. Yeah, go on.
I think with the onset of electric vehicles, I think an electric FJ Cruiser would be spot on.
Yeah.
I think that's a good time for it. All right, so let's see, where were we? It's up to almost 200,000 on the clock. Extremely reliable, of course it was, but it also drinks gas and has a terrible on-road characteristic and driving matter.
Fair.
I mean, of course it does. Yep. Can you imagine like an 11-year-old off-roader that was designed to be rough and tough back then? It's probably like driving a brand new Toyota 4Runner. Hey-o. All right. I continue on. Budget for a new vehicle is $12,000. Oh, I should mention he has a 1988 Toyota Supra with a Lexus V8 swap.
Sure.
That I use for weekend drives. This is a great letter, right?
Yeah, that's great.
All right. Now, somehow he manages to drive this around northern Minnesota. Okay. And have to get to work before the roads are plowed. So again, he's looking for a daily driver. All-wheel drive is preferred, could probably get by with front-wheel drive if it's the right car. I will say this, if you live in northern Minnesota, I think you're entitled to get all-wheel drive. A lot of times we tell people, no, just get snow tires, it's fine. I don't know. When you live that far north, you can get all-wheel drive if you want. You don't have to really explain that. Hatchbacks and wagons are the preferred style. Definitely don't want a crossover. This is daily driver. Would prefer it to be an automatic, as he has the Supra with the manual. Realize the perfect car is probably an older Outback or Forester, but he's generally opposed to Subarus, as there's so many of them in Minnesota.
Also fair.
If you think it's the right car, he might consider. So here's the short list. Volvo V50 all-wheel drive. Lexus IS 250/350 with all-wheel drive. Lexus CT200H. That's an interesting one. Mazda 3, Toyota Matrix, or the Mitsubishi Lancer Rally Art / Ralliart Sportback. As you can tell, he's got an affinity for sort of the weird and abnormal cars. He definitely is into things that you don't see every day. His current favorite in the leader of the clubhouse is the Lancer Ralliart, which is interesting. And that is about it. That's the letter. He's going to be at SEMA on Friday. And is just curious if anybody has any tips on how to get the most out of SEMA in one day. I've been to SEMA a bunch of times. We can get to that one. But let's start off with the spending his money. What do you think, James?
Okay, well, the Lexus is blah. No, as I said, the CT200H, that no. The Matrix, you can talk to Byron about that because he owns a Matrix.
That's true.
The Lancer Ralliart, that's interesting. I remember that Lancer. Cut. I didn't drive that version. That's a wacky pants car. So if you want that, that's fine. I can't say I love that Lancer. I guess it was better than every Mitsubishi that come after it, but the Volvo V50, that's a cool car. That's a very cool car. That interior is one of the coolest interiors of the last 20 years. That outside still looks great. It's very enjoyable to drive. If you can find one with a manual, that's a lovely car. It was the same platform as the Mazda 3, as well as the second generation Ford Focus, which we did not get. So I always said that car drove like a Mazda 3 with everything wrapped in marshmallow, which I kind of considered a good thing. So if you can get one of those, cool. And also the Mazda 3 on there, that's good. I'm not a fan of the big, happy, smiley one. But otherwise, so my off-the-wall suggestion here, and I'm not saying this theoretically, I'm directing you specifically to a car located in Middleton, Wisconsin, which I'm guessing is, you know, decently close to you. It's a 2010 Saab 93X.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's all-wheel drive. You'd be fine. It's with front-wheel drive. It's a Saab Sweden. Yeah. You don't need it, but all-wheel drive, that's cool. The Saab 3X was kind of like the Saab answer to the Audi Allroad / Volvo Cross Country. And it's gray, and it's definitely weird because it's a Saab. And that's an interesting car. Lots of space inside, all-wheel drive. There are, in fact, Saab service and parts centers in the greater Minneapolis area, at least. There's a lovely place in St. Paul that will take care of you. They still do make Saab parts out there. And I'm sure you can get a good service place if you're concerned about buying a car that, you know, they don't sell them anymore. That was a solid car. Oh, by the way, its exact asking price is $12,205 from a private seller. Saab 93X. That's a neat car.
Okay, wow. That is definitely a deep cut. And that's, you know, you're talking about a deep cut out of question that is filled with a lot of B-sided sort of elements here. But that'll work. So I'll go a couple different ways here. One is Volvo V50. It's all wheel drive. It's a Volvo. It's a wagon. I think you're going to like that. I realize you're trying to play with about $12,000. So you're not going to go get a brand new vehicle. But you're still at that point. The V50 hasn't been around for a while. So you're still getting probably a fairly elderly, maybe isn't quite the right word, but an older vehicle. And if you're okay with that, sounds like you might be, go for it. I think that could be a fun car for sure. I actually also like the Lancer Ralliart and the Ralliart Sportback. That's kind of strange, but it just, you know, it was, they were in the fleets like 10 years ago, if you will. I remember driving them at Auto Week. They were fun cars. That's kind of fun. You know, there's actually an interesting piece here on Car Driver about the 2010 Mitsubishi Lancer Sportback Ralliart, which if you Google it, you can find it. It's from 2011. They looks like they had a long-termer with it and rolled up 40,000 miles. So that's kind of cool. I actually worked with both the author and the photographer Well, I didn't work with the author. I drove the Rubicon Trail with him. So small world. So, you know, those are two you could look at if you're interested. As far as like, if you want me to sort of confirm that, you know, the rally art could be fun. I think it could be fun. I also like the Volvo V50. And then I will play the Subaru card. I think that's kind of the responsible choice here. Getting as much Outback or Forester as you can for 12 grand. I mean, that's a pretty smart move. You know, you're going to be able to plow through, you know, all sorts of, you know, snowfall on the way to, you know, try to get the Minnesota Wild, you know, into the playoffs or something, try to go see those games. That'll serve you well. So I think that's a very, again, responsible choice. If you want to go a little different, try the Mitsubishi or the Volvo.
I have a related one. I don't know if they might be a little too expensive, but it's not like you can even, I looked up V50s just now. They're a little rare in that neck of the woods. The related Volvo C30, that hatchback thing, that was a cool car. Front wheel drive, fun. But related to the V50. That was a neat car with that all glass hatchback. Yeah. Look for one of those.
I vividly remember driving one of those to go to I forget what it was. It was like a wedding rehearsal dinner planning for my own wedding. And I remember driving and I was like, this is pretty cool. And the caterer was like, hey man, what is that car you're showing up in? That's pretty wild. So yeah. So Hayden, let us know how it works out. I think it's, you know, stay in touch. Glad you're still listening to the podcast after all these years. SEMA's a fun show. I covered it every year for about, I want to say 08 until probably 16, almost every year in there. Three different outlets I covered it for. Press days are pretty fun because they're a little, like there's fewer people there. If I recall, at least the way it used to be, the press day was still kind of a public setting. If you're going to go on the Friday of the week of SEMA, everything will still be there. My suggestion would be to check out any of the OEMs that have stands because those are usually pretty cool. You'll see a lot of our coverage, if you will, of those already on Autoblog. So you can kind of do that as a spotter's guide. It's also good to check out kind of like just all the different tuners, whether it's you know, the crazy like stuff, or whether you can see like if Chip Foose or people like that are there, those are always good to check out. You know, you go into some of the other places, I think there's less to see. Like if you get into like the tire hall or the wheels or like some of just the aftermarket parts, if you're looking for those things, cool, check them out. This is a great place to do it. But if you just want to see some of the more like high profile stuff, you know, some of the domestics have actually pulled back from SEMA, but it still sounds like there's going to be stuff going on there this year. So it's always a fun show to go to, I think. Stellantis, they weren't even Stellantis at that point, I guess. It was still Chrysler. They used to end the press day by handing out press kits and turning their press little like stand into a bar. So that was pretty nice, complete with beer on tap. They'd hand you you know, the latest, craziest thing on whatever Mopar thing they showed or whatever Jeep, and a draft beer. It's tough to beat that for a press conference. So that's a show. I've been asking everybody what their fall drinks are. James, is there a beverage you are concocting? I don't know. NyQuil, a little yeah. Raspy.
Yeah. If you haven't noticed, I've felt better, folks. No, my bar is still is not constructed yet. I have moved to California, but I am not yet living in my house. So I just mostly drink whatever is left over from my sister-in-law's wedding 3 years ago that has ended up above the fridge at my in-law's house. So I'm just working on the dregs of a bottle of Jim Beam at this point that I might drink sometimes while watching TV. It's not great. My bar game has gone down significantly, and all of the beer that I smuggled, not really smuggled, you could totally completely come down with, there's no problem bringing alcohol across from state lines, but it's fun to say you smuggle it. When I moved from Oregon, I brought like a lot of beer with me that I know I wouldn't be able to buy here. So that's in storage waiting for its rightful home in the beer fridge. Funny you should ask.
All right. Well, that is definitely, this has been a little bit of a deep cut show. That is a deep cut right there. Usually I get people talking about whatever brewery they've been breezing into and, you know, getting a new flavor or something for fall.
I've gone nowhere.
The dregs of a bottle of Jim Beam. All right. Good luck with that. I have been drinking gin and tonics with some Griffin Claw gin. If you are in the metro area, you probably like Metro Detroit area, you probably like the brewery Griffin Claw. We actually used to do video shoots there. So I always like to make it my business to grab a bottle of gin from there when I need some. So if you like gin or you like this podcast, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get the show. Send us your Spend My Monies. That's podcast@autoblog.com. Be safe out there, and we will see you next week.